asked for him to come at his earliest convenience. That, of course, meant reaching for his coat and hat after the quick conversation with his wife and accompanying the courier back to Stormwind Keep. He was escorted to the petitioner's chamber. It was a large, austere room. Lit by lamps and candles, it included an area with a thick, richly embroidered rug and a few benches as well as a small table with four chairs in the center. A nobleman with an elegantly trimmed beard and two long graying braids of hair greeted him, introducing himself as Count Remington Ridgewell. Frederick was invited to take a seat.
"No thank you, my lord, count," he stammered.
How did one address a count anyway?
"I prefer to stand if it please you," he said.
"It matters not at all to me," the count said.
He stepped back a few paces and clasped his hands behind his back, waiting. Frederick removed his cap and held it, now and then nervously running a hand over his bald pate. He expected to be kept waiting for a while. Kings, he supposed, had quite a lot of things they needed to do in a day. He looked about the great chamber. "So big. I could fit the entirety of the Lion's Pride in here with room to spare," he mused.
"Am I addressing the innkeeper, Frederick Farley?"
came a pleasant, youthful-sounding voice. Frederick turned, expecting to see a squire, and instead found himself face to face with King Anduin Rin. But the ruler of Stormwind was not alone. An older woman stood beside the king, dressed in a flowing white robe, and slightly behind him was a muscular older man with white hair, a neatly trimmed beard, and piercing blue eyes.
"Your Majesty," Frederick said, his voice climbing with surprise. "Your pardon, I wasn't..."
"He's so young," Frederick thought. "My Anna is older than he is. I hadn't realized that." The startlingly young king smiled easily and indicated a chair.
"Please, do sit. Thank you for coming."
Frederick edged toward the chair and sank down, still holding his hat. The king sat down across from him, and the priestess and the older man who had accompanied him did likewise. King Anduin folded his hands and regarded Frederick steadily, but kindly. The older man crossed his arms and leaned back in his seat. In contrast to the king and the priestess, he looked almost angry. Frederick thought him familiar-looking, but couldn't place him.
"I'm sorry for the mystery of all this, but it's a bit of a delicate matter, and I wanted to speak with you myself."
Frederick knew his eyes were as big as eggs at that point, but he was utterly unable to do anything about it. He gulped. Anduin waved to the attendant nobleman.
"Wine for Mr. Farley, please, Count Ridgewell. Or would you prefer a beer?"
"The King of Stormwind is asking me if I want wine or beer," Frederick thought. The world had gone mad.
Whatever you're having, Your Majesty."
"A bottle of peaked Dalaran Red," he said, and the count nodded and left.
The king returned his gaze to Frederick.
"You're an innkeeper? I'm sure you'll be familiar with my selection."
Frederick was indeed familiar with the vintage, but it wasn't something there was much call for in the Lion's Pride, as the price was exorbitant.
"I'm offering you a glass now, because we're going to toast a very brave man," the king continued. "And then I'm going to ask you if you yourself would, if it were possible, be inclined to do a very brave thing."
Frederick nodded.
"Of course, sir. It's as you wish."
The priestess placed a gentle hand on his arm.
"I know it's hard not to be nervous, but I promise you, you're free to leave at any time. His Majesty's request is just that, not an order."
Frederick felt some of the trepidation abate, and his heart, which had been pounding fiercely ever since the courier had arrived at the inn, finally started to slow down, despite the older man's glower.
"Thank you, priestess,"
Anduin continued.
"It's my understanding you lost your brother to the plague. I want you to know that I am truly sorry for your loss."
This wasn't at all what Frederick had been expecting. He felt like he'd been gut-punched. But the young king's blue eyes remained friendly and sympathetic, and Frederick found himself speaking freely.
"Aye," Frederick said. "We was close as boys. Frandis always liked to play with swords. He was good at it. Ever so much better than me. Got a job guarding supply caravans from ruffians. He would go from here to Ironforge or wherever the caravans went. That day, they went to Lordaeron."
The boy, no, Frederick, the king, looked down for a minute,
And you thought Frandis died, didn't you? Sudden hope seized the innkeeper.
He's not? Is he alive?
The king shook his blonde head sadly.
No. But he eventually became a Forsaken. And it was as a Forsaken that he became a hero. He was killed because he defied a tyrant, the war chief of the Horde, Garrosh Hellscream. He died because he wouldn't follow orders he knew were wrong and cruel.
Count Ridgewell returned, bearing a tray with four glasses and the promised wine. The king nodded his thanks and filled the glasses. Frederick reached for his, careful not to hold the fragile blown glass too tightly. It was not the heavy mugs he was accustomed to at his tavern, that was for certain. Frandis, his brother, had been forsaken. Abruptly, Frederick started to tremble, and the wine sloshed around in the beautiful goblet. He took a gulp to steady his nerves, then kicked himself for not savoring the rare vintage.
A hero, Frederick said, repeating King Anduin's words. That don't sound like a forsaken, he added cautiously, wondering if this was some kind of game.
Not like what we think of as forsaken, no, the woman said. Beside her, the gray-haired man was looking increasingly irritated. But does it sound like Frandis? The king asked. Tears shimmered in Frederick's eyes.
It do, he said. He were a good man, your majesty.
I know, the king said. And he was a good man even after he died. There are other forsaken who also retain themselves even after their transition. Not all of them, certainly, but some.
Don't seem possible, Frederick murmured.
Let me ask you a question, the king said. Let's suppose, by some chance, Frandis was still with us, as a Forsaken. Knowing that he was still largely himself, still the good man who was your brother, would you have liked to meet with him? Frederick dropped his gaze to his lap. He saw that his large, strong hands had been clutching and twisting his hat until it had completely lost its shape. What a question. Would he want that? Bear in mind as you answer, this may be your brother, but he would also be a Forsaken. For the first time the older man had spoken. His voice was deep and almost had a growl to it.
He wouldn't be alive. He might be rotting. Bones would likely be jutting through his skin. He would have done terrible things as a member of the Scourge, and he would serve the Banshee Queen. Would you still be interested in meeting your brother?
King Anduin did not look pleased with the older man's words, but he did not silence him either. Frederick felt cold, reeling from the graphic picture that had been painted. It would be terrifying to come face to face with what? Or more important, with who? With a monster? Or with his brother? Frederick would have to find that out for himself, wouldn't he? The innkeeper swallowed hard, and looked squarely first at the boyish face of his king, then at the gentle one of the priestess, then, less willingly, at the almost angry older man. His answer was for his king.
Yes, Your Majesty, he stated. I'd have wanted to see him, and if he was as you say he was, someone who tried to stop something evil, then he'd still be my brother.
The king and the priestess exchanged pleased glances, and the king refilled Frederick's glass, while the older man shook his head and sighed in frustration.
Chapter 24 Stormwind. Over the next few days, Anduin and Kalia took the list of human names Sylvanas had given them and dispatched letters to all those mentioned. Anduin himself wrote them, rather than having a scribe do so. He made it clear that participation in the gathering, as he and Kalia found themselves calling it, was completely voluntary. No harm will come to you or your family if you refuse, he said in the missive. This is not an order, but rather an invitation, a chance to see your loved ones again, although they are different from the ones you recall. The couriers delivering the letters had been instructed not to leave without a reply. Some of those on the list were literate and wrote their own responses. Others dictated them to the courier. Anduin looked at the pile of responses and sighed. Counting today's batch, there are more refusals than acceptances, he said. Kalia smiled sadly, but kindly. That shouldn't surprise you, she replied. No, It doesn't. And that's why it's painful, he thought, but did not say.
But there were some who accepted right away, she reminded him. And every member of the council submitted 5 names, anticipating that some might not want to be involved.
True. It was good for him to remember that. Their task was still just beginning. All the people who did respond positively would have to be interviewed to ensure that their desire to reunite with family or friends stemmed from love and concern rather than vengeance. Others of his advisors had offered to aid Kalia and Anduin in the process, but the young king had refused them. It was a bitter thing, but he didn't trust them to be unbiased. He'd seen how unhappy Gen had been with Frederick Farley. People needed to understand what they might encounter, but they didn't need to be bullied into refusing. Anduin had been informed that negative sentiment was not limited to his advisors. Guards and Shaw's people had reported that there was muttering in some of the taverns and on the streets. The guards had been instructed to interrupt such conversations if they verged on sedition or grew violent. So far, nothing untoward had happened. The hatred expressed, the guards reported, was toward Sylvanas and the Horde for what they had done to their loved ones. Some still believed that death was better than becoming monsters. Communication between himself and the Banshee Queen continued to go surprisingly well. They had hammered out a set of rules that each agreed to adhere to, and that had even passed muster among his advisors for safety purposes. Everyone was, if not exactly happy, approving of the spot selected, the numbers chosen, and the steps that would be followed from the arrival of each faction's forces to the time and manner of their departure. At one point, Gen had confronted Anduin and asked him point blank,
"How can you work so easily with the creature who betrayed your father? There's more blood on her hands than there is water in the ocean."
"It's not easy," Anduin had replied. "And she does have blood on her hands. We all do. No, Gen, I can't change the past. But if this goes well, then I can change the future. One person, one mind, one heart at a time. And maybe that will be enough so that a fresh outbreak of war fueled by Azerite won't wipe out every one of us."
The days passed. Anduin and Kalia continued to meet with those whose names were on the provided list. Some were like Frederick, individuals who struggled with the concept of a Forsaken as a person, but yearned for connection. Others, though they might have expressed a willingness to meet with their Forsaken kin in the letter, were deemed unsuitable. Kalia was a keen observer, and Anduin trusted the old injuries he had received from the Divine Bell to guide his decisions. And sometimes, sadly, it was quite obvious that the reunion would have resulted in violence. There was an undercurrent of hostility, an unvoiced desire to punish the Forsaken simply for the act of having died and been reborn. Others, usually with more than sufficient reason, were openly angry at Sylvanas. They were given coin and refreshment for their time, and dismissed. "Hate," Anduin once said to Kalia, "always surprises me. It shouldn't, but it does." She nodded her golden head sadly. "As priests, we cannot harden our hearts and still do what the light would have us do. Vulnerability is our strength and our weakness both, but I would have it no other way." The candles had burned low in the chamber on the final day as the last person settled into the chair. Her name was Filia Fentalis, and the person who had asked for her was her father, Parqual. Filia looked to be about 15 years old, if that. She had large, expressive eyes and a small button nose. With the vibrancy of her demeanor, she seemed as far removed from a Forsaken as the summer from the winter.
"My father was a historian in Lordaeron, and I was born there," she said. "But we had family here. Aunts, uncles, cousins. And I had come back for a visit. I was supposed to have gone home the day after..."
She broke off, and tears welled in her eyes. Anduin fished out a handkerchief and handed it to her. She accepted it with a trembling smile of thanks and sipped at the water Kalia had poured for her. "After Arthas came," Anduin finished for her. He sneaked a glance at Kalia. He couldn't count the number of times her brother's name had been mentioned during these meetings with survivors, and everyone had cursed him heartily. On some level, it had to wound that man's sister. Anduin never identified Kalia by name, and she never reacted to the vile things that were said about the slain Lich King. He admired her strength, particularly given what she had said about not hardening her heart.
Philia nodded miserably, then took a deep breath and continued. We never heard anything from Mama or Papa, so we assumed they were dead. Hoped they were dead, given all we had heard about the Scourge. Oh, isn't that horrible now that I know? I have to tell you that my uncle didn't want me to come when I got your letter, Your Majesty. But I had to. If by some miracle it's still him, I have to see him. I have to see my Papa. Her voice caught as the tears she had tried so hard to contain spilled down her cheeks. Kalia had unfailingly been kind and comforting to all she and Anduin had spoken with, but this girl's obvious love clearly struck her powerfully. She rose and went to Philia, holding her tightly, letting her sob against her shoulder. Anduin thought he glimpsed tears in the priestess's eyes as the two women clung to each other, and a thought struck him. It was a delicate subject, but one he needed to broach with Kalia once their task here was completed. It's true, I promise you, he said to Philia. I haven't met your father, but I have encountered many Forsaken who remember who they were, and who would be very happy to be reunited with those who have thought them dead or destroyed beyond recognition. Kalia took a step back from the girl, placing her hands on her shoulders. Philia, look at me. The girl did so, gulping, her eyes red and swollen. I have heard of your father from someone who knows him as he is now. He speaks very highly of him, and tells me he is still kind and intelligent. I believe it will be a joyful reunion for you both. Thank you. Thank you so much. When will this happen?
We will send a courier with instructions, Anduin promised her. Hopefully not too long. When the girl left, beaming with joy, Kalia gave Anduin a smile, even though her face was still flushed from the empathetic tears she had shed. I hope you see now what good you do, Anduin Rin. He gave her a lopsided grin. I hope it will be good, he said. I'll relax when it's all over. I couldn't have done this without you, Kalia. You have a gift for reading people. That was something I learned from an early age as a royal child, as I'm sure you did. Working so closely with so many fellow priests has only helped to hone that skill and temper it with compassion. There was a pause. Kalia herself had just provided him a segue into the conversation he wished to have with her. But even so, Anduin steeled himself. Kalia, he began carefully, you have been a tremendous help, and you aren't a Stormwind citizen. If this plan does lead eventually to peace, you'll be a hero of the Alliance. She smiled a touch ruefully. Thank you, but I don't consider myself a member of the Alliance. I'm a citizen of nowhere now, except perhaps the Netherlight Temple, she said. I go where the light wills me. I truly believe this is the right path toward mending other, greater rifts. Anduin couldn't let it go without making absolutely certain. Too much was at stake. The Kingdom of Lordaeron is your birthright. Few would be willing to let go of such a title, and the power it would grant them, he pressed. I understand your reasoning, but many do not. You may have some nationalist champions rising, ready to take the city in your name. Suddenly her expression grew thoughtful, and she searched his eyes. Would you be among them, Anduin? Is that why you ask? Would the King of Stormwind make war on the Horde, scour the Undercity to grant the Queen of Lordaeron her empty kingdom? The throne was hers by every right. Yet was it worth war should she express a desire to claim it? She saw the struggle on his face and put a hand on his. I understand. Don't worry. Those who currently inhabit Lordaeron live there in life. The Forsaken are the true heirs. It belongs to them now. The best I can do for those whom I would have ruled is exactly what I'm doing. I've found a peace and a calling where I can really matter. That's more important than a bloodied crown. Sacrificing peace and a calling is usually the price of a crown, Anduin said. You have not let it be so. Stormwind is fortunate to have you. But if you truly wish to thank me, I have a favor to ask, of both you and the Archbishop. I'd like to participate in the gathering. Anduin frowned slightly. I don't think that is wise, he said. There may be those who recognize you. It could be dangerous. It could be misconstrued. It could, in fact, lead to war.
If any of the Forsaken do recognize me, it will give me the chance to show that I bear them no ill will, she countered, that I have no desire to run them out of the place that's been their home for so long. I want them to stay there. I want them to be safe.
Anduin watched her carefully, taking a breath and centering himself.
Light, let me know if she means them harm.
He felt no responding ache in his bones, no hint that Kalia Menethil was planning some kind of murderous coup. Her intentions were in alignment with the light they both served.
I've already established a bond of trust with these people we've interviewed, she continued, and no one knows the Archbishop better than I do.
This was true, and no one knew her better than Thal.
I will speak with the Archbishop, Anduin said at last. If he is agreeable, then I am too.
Kalia beamed at him.
Thank you, she said. It means more than you know.
There was one last thing he felt compelled to say.
I have a question, and it's important that I know the answer.
Her golden hair, as golden as that of Arthas, as golden as his own, fell in a bright sheet to hide her face as she looked down. Her voice was small when she spoke.
I trust you, Anduin, she said. If you feel you must know the answer, then ask it.
He took a deep breath.
Kalia, is there a child?
Do you have an heir?
Chapter 25 Stormwind.
The unspoken words hung between them, heavy and sad, and Anduin knew the answer before she gave it.
There was a child,
Kalia Menethil said so softly he had to strain to hear her. It was enough. But Anduin waited to see if she was ready to tell her story. Just as he drew breath to change the subject, she began to speak.
You must understand, my father was ordinarily a kind and understanding man. But on this one thing he was firm. He was to choose the man I was to marry, and I was to agree to it.
Her sorrowful sea-green eyes lifted from the clasped hands in her lap.
I have made many mistakes and poor choices in my life. Everyone has. But as royalty, our decisions matter more than those of others because they affect so many more people. You may feel you have to find a queen, have an heir. Your advisors will want you to make a good political match. Others might be able to live with such things, but not people like us. Promise me this, Anduin. Whatever anyone tells you to do, don't marry if your heart doesn't tell you to.
Her face was fierce, but still beautiful and haunted, and her words struck him with the power of truth. Even so, Anduin knew that in the end, he would have to do what was best for his kingdom.
I cannot make a promise I may not be able to keep, he said. But for what it's worth, I share your feelings on this matter. We all do what we must, Kalia said. I was not the direct heir. I don't have your responsibilities. If I had, I might have agreed without protest. But Arthas was the heir, the firstborn son. And as he grew up, Papa began to focus more on him. It seemed as though he and Jaina would be a perfect couple, a love match as well as a sound political one. At least until Arthas somehow decided that it wasn't perfect.
She paused, then looked up at him.
Jaina, I've been afraid to ask you. Is she...
She's alive, Anduin hastened to reassure her. We don't know where she is, but she can take care of herself. He did not tell her of Jaina's struggles or of her apparent abandonment of the Alliance. Kalia had enough sorrows on her heart. Anduin had no desire to add to them unless she inquired. His words seemed to be enough for her. She smiled, her eyes distant, and said,
I'm glad. She was dear to me when we were younger, when the world was less cruel than now. And with what Arthas became, I am deeply glad she was not wed to him. But while Father's eye was on my brother, I conducted my own quiet rebellion. I fell in love with someone Father never would have approved of, one of the footmen. We stole what moments we could, and once in the dark of night, we slipped away and begged a priestess to marry us. She refused at first, but we persisted. We came to her again and again, my sweet love and I. And at last, with the light's blessing, we were wed.
Her hand fell to her belly, flat now, but once rounded with child.
When I was certain that I was carrying, I confided in Mother. Oh, she was furious with me. But she could tell by my face that this was a true love, and I assured her my child would be legitimate. Father was too caught up in Arthas to make much objection when my mother and I went on a long rest to more remote parts of the kingdom.
Kalia's hand ceased to move on her abdomen, and both hands curled into fists.
I got to hold my beautiful little girl and tend to her for a few weeks before it was decided that my husband would raise her, away from Lordaeron, and ignorant of her birthright. Mother promised that when the time was right, when Arthas had finally married and produced an heir, we could acknowledge my daughter, and perhaps elevate my husband to a nobleman's status, so that her name would be unsullied. That day never came, but the scourge did.
Anduin listened, his heart full of sympathy. Kalia was describing being sold off like livestock to the highest bidder. She'd rebelled, fallen in love, and conceived a child. A daughter. For a brief moment, Anduin wondered what a daughter or son of his would look like. Regardless of appearance or gender, that babe would rule one day, and until then, would be deeply loved.
I don't remember much of that time. I remember lying in a ditch while the scourge passed above me. I believe to this day, it was thanks to the light that they never found me. I made my way to South Shore, where my husband and child had been hidden away. We all three wept when we were reunited, but it was not to last. No. Not a second time.
Anduin reached for one of her fisted hands. For a moment, it was tense beneath his, and then slowly the fist unclenched as Kalia allowed her fingers to entwine with his.
You don't have to say anything else, Kalia. I'm sorry I troubled you. It's all right, she said. I've started now. I think I want to finish.
Only if you wish, he assured her. She gave him a faint smile.
Maybe if I tell someone, the nightmares will stop.
Inwardly, he winced. He had no response to that. She continued.
No one recognized me. Everyone assumed I was dead. We were happy for a time. And then came the blight. We ran. I wasn't about to leave my family again, but in the crowd we were separated. I stood in the middle of the street screaming for them. Someone took pity on me, pulling me onto his horse and galloping past the limits of town barely in time. There was a cluster of refugees in the forest. So many of us waited, desperate for word of our loved ones. Sometimes prayers were answered and there were reunions that were...
Kalia bit her lip.
I prayed that my family too would be spared, but...
Her voice trailed off.
I never saw them again.
And then, with a realization that stopped his breathing with shock, Anduin understood why Kalia had decided to befriend the Forsaken. Why, instead of seeing them as the destroyers of her city, her way of life, and all her family, she had chosen to identify with them. You're hoping that your husband and child, too, became Forsaken, instead of dying as scourge, he said softly. You're hoping you'll get word of them at the gathering. Kalia nodded, wiping at the tears on her face with one hand. The other remained clasped with the young king's.
Yes, she said. It wasn't until I met the Archbishop that I started to understand that the Forsaken weren't monsters. They were just us. The same people you and I would be if we had been killed and given a different sort of life.
You don't know if your family would have been like that, Anduin cautioned. They could have been driven mad or turned cruel. It might be devastating for you to see them. Gen's words to Frederick came back to him now, even as he spoke.
I know, but I have to hold out for the chance. Isn't that what the light is all about, Anduin? Hope.
Anduin's mind went back to the trial of Garrosh Hellscream. When that orc had executed his escape, he had done so thanks to the chaos sown by an unexpected attack on the temple. In that battle, Jaina had been severely wounded. No, he corrected himself. She had been dying. So many tried to heal her, both Alliance and Horde, but the wound was too much. Anduin remembered kneeling on the cold stone floor of the temple, watching Jaina's labored breathing and seeing red bubbles form on her lips, his hands on her bloodied robe. Please, please, he had prayed. and the light had come. But he, like the others, was exhausted, and the light he had called would not be enough to save her. He remembered others telling him to come away, that he'd done all he could. But he stayed there, in those bleak, impotent moments before the death of this woman he'd loved as an aunt. "No," he had told those who wanted him to walk away. "I can't." And then the voice of his teacher, Chi-Chi, the Red Crane. "And so the student remembers the lessons of my temple." Anduin quoted Chi-Chi's words to Kalia now. "Hope is what you have when all other things have failed you," he said. "Where there is hope, you make room for healing, for all things that are possible, and some that are not." Her eyes shone, and she gave him a tremulous smile. "You understand," she said. "I do," he said, "and I know that having you participate in the gathering is the right thing to do." As he spoke, he felt warmth and calmness steal through him. That warmth passed through their clasped hands to Kalia, and he saw the lines around her eyes and mouth lessen, her body relax. Whatever betided, this act of kindness was the right thing. Anduin had to hope that they would not pay too dear a price for it. Tanaris. The team of goblin engineer and gnome mineralogist picked up their pace. Safi grilled Grizzik on everything he knew about his boss, and it killed him to watch her face, normally so bright and cheerful, especially recently, grow darker and more withdrawn. Sometimes Grizzik bridled at how his people were regarded, or more accurately, reviled. Not all goblins were out to sell dangerous things at ludicrous prices. There were some who were even well-regarded. Gaslow, who operated out of Ratchet, south of Orgrimmar, came to mind. But Jaster Gallywix epitomized the worst that could possibly be said about goblins. He was cunning, selfish, arrogant, completely ruthless, and unburdened by remorse. He'd even sold his own people into slavery right after the Cataclysm hit, for crying out loud. Grizzik and his darling Punkin had become so engrossed in the breathtaking magnificence of Azurite that they'd lost sight of what surely was at the heart of Gallywix's desire to learn about it. Its ability to kill anyone that goblin chose. "This is all my fault," Grizzik said at one point, more miserable than he'd ever been in his life. "I should never have trusted Gallywix to keep his promise. Should have known he'd want me to make weapons. And worst of all, I should never have dragged you into this. I'm so sorry." "Hey," Safi said, slipping into his arms and snuggling against his sunken green chest. "While I cannot approve of your methods, I'm glad we're working on this. You were right. You knew I'd want to be involved. I may have come here kicking and screaming, literally, but I stayed because I wanted to. And because..." Grizzik caught his breath. Was she going to say? "Because I'm glad that we found each other again. This Azurite is powerful stuff. Its natural state is toward growth and healing. Maybe even Gallywix will understand that it's much better to put it to those kind of uses." "Pookie," he said. "He's a goblin. We like to blow things up." She was, of course, unable to deny the truth in this. "Well," she hemmed, "building and healing are just as important as destroying and killing." Safraneta was so naive, and he loved her so much for it. By the time Gallywix showed up, all big belly, big attitude, and big smiles, they were ready. "Trade Prince," Grizzik said. "Please allow me to introduce my lab partner, Safraneta Flivers." Safi dropped a curtsy, which looked ridiculous but endearing, as she was wearing overalls and clunky boots. Gallywix appeared charmed.
"Delighted, delighted," he boomed in his abrasive, raspy voice, taking her hand and pressing his lips on it.
Safi turned pale but did not pull away.
"You were worth every copper to kidnap, my dear, and I haven't even seen your work yet."
Thanks, she said.
Her eyes narrowed, and it was obvious she wanted nothing more than to deck him. But again she refrained from actions that would probably result in their imprisonment and or execution.
"We've been working on a variety of things," Grizzik began, but Gallywix cut him off.
"Lots of weapons, I hope,"
Gallywix said as he trundled through the door into the courtyard.
"Our war chief is extremely interested in things that go boom. And I told her,
"War Chief," I says. "Don't you worry, honey. I got the best guy who makes things go boom."
"Actually," Safi said, forcing a smile, "goblins already excel at making things go boom. What we've been working on is much more valuable." They led him inside to the lab, arranged with an eye to impress were all their labors of love. They proceeded to put the items through their paces as Gallywix watched, his tiny eyes fixed hungrily on the Azurite. First, they shared the wearable items, the jewelry and trinkets.
"We got our inspiration from you," Grizzik said. "Your cane was the very first adornment made of Azurite."
Gallywix beamed and petted the glowing golden orb under discussion. Safi discussed the properties of the various trinkets, and Grizzik brought out the armor they'd crafted.
"Holy smokes!"
Gallywix exclaimed as he watched the armor take minute after minute of direct fire from the Lightning Blast 3000. Next up was Crunchy's demonstration. Grizzik had rebuilt the damaged hand and winced afresh as yet again it was destroyed when the modified shredder tried to crush a lump of Azurite.
"My, my," Gallywix said. "That's tough stuff."
"Think of the building material you could make from it," Safi said. "It could withstand fires, earthquakes."
"Think of the shredders we could make."
Yes. Let's move on." Next, Safi demonstrated what Grizzik referred to as her best parlor trick of neutralizing poison and licking it off her hand.
"You won't need to craft specific antidotes," she said. "Just carry around some of this and keep it liquid. No matter the poison, it's no longer a problem."
"Ha ha! When we use it, poison is never a problem."
All of Gallywix's chins and his belly, too, jiggled with his guffaws. Grizzik was starting to feel sick to his stomach. His poor Safi was looking as if she felt the same way. By the end of the demonstrations, Gallywix was not looking very happy.
"I asked you for weapons," he said. "Specifically, by name."
Yeah, Grizzik said. "About that,
some things could be modified into weapons," Safi said, startling Grizzik.
"But I highly urge you not to do so. What we've shown you could save lives. Hoard lives."
That admission was hard for her, but she persevered.
"You can build structures that the Alliance can't attack. You can extend lives, heal wounds, save people who otherwise might have died. This helps the Horde. You don't need weapons."
Gallywix sighed and looked at Safi with an expression that was almost kind and nearly respectful.
"You're a cutie and a smarty," he said. "So I'll tell you nicely. We're in a world that's always going to be at war, sweet cheeks. And the only ones who survive it are the ones with the biggest weapons. Grizzik here understands. You gnomes seem to have problems with that concept. Sure, sure, this Azurite does all the things you say it's gonna do. We will make buildings and cure sickness and save lives. But we're also going to grind the Alliance down beneath our heels. And Miss Smarty Pants, you need to decide if you're gonna be on the winning side when that all goes down. Believe me when I say I hope so."
He looked at Grizzik, stabbing a finger at him to punctuate the words.
"Weapons. Pronto."
Then he tipped his hideous hat to Safi and waddled out. For several long moments, neither Grizzik nor Safi spoke. Then quietly, Safi said,
"What he's going to do with the Azurite, those will be crimes against Gnomanity, and humanity, and goblins, and orcs, and everyone. Everyone, Grizzy."
"I know," he said just as quietly. "And we will have made it possible for him to do it."
Grizzik was silent. He knew that too. She turned to him, her eyes wide and shimmering with tears.
"Azurite is part of Azeroth. We can't let him do that to her. We can't let him do that to us. Somehow we've got to stop him."
"We can't stop him, Safi," Grizzik replied.
His eyes roamed the magnificent things the two of them had made out of their passion for science and tinkering, and for each other. All of them made his heart swell with pride and then ache with terror for how they would be used. She came to him and started weeping softly. He put his arms around her, trying to hold her tight enough to shut out the pain of their complicity. Then a thought occurred to him.
"We can't stop him," he repeated. "But I think I have a plan.
on how we can stop something.
Chapter 26. Stormwind.
Thank you for coming, Anduin said to his guests. I know the hour is late, but it is important.
So your letter said,
Tyrallian replied. It was indeed late, well past midnight, but the young king suspected that neither Greymane nor Tyrallian had yet seen his bed. Too much was going on. The king had requested their presences in the Cathedral of Light. A few acolytes and novices moved about even at this hour, but most of the priests were gone. He awaited them at the narthex of the cathedral and indicated that they should join him as he walked down the aisle toward the altar. I wanted to give you an update on where we stand for the gathering, Anduin said. They frowned, exchanging glances.
Your Majesty, Gant said. We have already given you our opinion on this.
We have,
Tyrallian said.
With respect, Your Majesty, we have a fundamental disagreement on the Light's intentions and purpose.
He hesitated.
I do not condemn you for your feelings. It would not be the first time a devotee has misunderstood the Light. I know I have. I don't claim to be perfect or to have a true comprehension of it. No one can.
But you both do feel that this is wrong? Anduin pressed. That there is nothing to be gained by having Forsaken and humans meeting when a prior bond had existed between them.
We have made that clear, Your Majesty, Tyrallian stated. If you have bidden us to come here at this hour simply to rehash this argument with you.
No, Anduin said. Not with me.
With me?
Came a rich, warm, oddly echoing voice. They turned around. Archbishop Alonsus Fowl stood on the blue steps leading up to the altar. He was clad in a mitre and robe that bespoke his stature in life. Anduin had looked diligently for the garments. It was, he had realized, easier for humans to recognize the outer trappings of an archbishop than what remained of the man himself. Both Greymane and Tyrallian seemed stunned. Anduin waited but did not speak. This had to unfold between Fowl and his oldest, dearest friends without interference from outsiders. Anduin said a silent prayer that everyone in this room would look with eyes of remembered friendship and see truly.
I'm quite aware that I don't look as you remember me, Fowl continued. But I think you recognize my voice. And my face is mostly intact, though it lacks that bushy white beard I was so fond of.
Tyrallian went as still as if he were the statue that stood at the entrance to Stormwind. The only thing that proved he was not was the rapid rise and fall of his chest. The expression on his face was one of utter loathing, but he did not speak or move. If Tyrallian's reaction was cold, Gen's was pure fire. He whirled on Anduin, his face contorted in fury. Not for the first time, the young king was aware of the sheer power of the man even when he wasn't in his worgen form. He needed no claws and teeth, not even a sword to kill, and right now he looked as though he was about to rip Anduin apart with his bare hands.
You've gone too far, Anduin Rin, Greymane snarled. How dare you bring this thing into the Cathedral of Light? You're chasing this distorted ideal of what peace really is, and now you've brought that here.
His voice shook.
Alonsus Fowl was my friend. He was Tyrallian's friend. We'd accepted that he was gone. He was buried at Fowl's rest. Why are you doing this to us?
Anduin didn't flinch. He'd been expecting this reaction. When he got no response, Greymane turned on the source of his loathing.
Have you got the boy under some sort of spell, wretch? He bellowed. I know that there are priests who can do that sort of thing. Let Anduin go. Get out of here, and I will not rip that putrid corpse of yours to shreds. You chose this shambling existence. You chose to be this creature of nightmares, and you have to know what's happened to me, to my people, what yours did to me, and how much I loathe what you've become. If you had any decency, any respect for those you once called friends, you'd have hurled yourself into the fire during your first Hallow's End and spared us all this.
Anduin closed his eyes in pain at the vitriol Greymane was hurling at a man he'd loved in life. He had known this would be difficult, but he had not expected Gen to be so malicious in his anger. Fowl, though, seemed completely unsurprised by the reaction, and looked at Gen sadly.
You stand there, a few strides away from an old friend, and you attack me with words chosen for their power to wound, Fowl said. And I know why you do so. I do so because you are a monstrosity. Because your people are an abomination and should never have been created.
Fowl shook his head. His voice remained calm, tinged with a hint of sorrow.
No, my old friend. You do this because you are afraid.
Anduin blinked, shocked. Ghen Greymane was many things, but he was no coward. Anduin did not want to interfere, but if it looked like Fowl was in danger, he would do so. Although Fowl was probably a more powerful priest, even in his present state, than Anduin could ever be. Greymane stood absolutely still.
I've killed for lesser insults than that.
The words were pitched low, a growl.
I know that, Fowl continued. And yet I say again, you are afraid. Oh, not of me personally.
He put a withered hand on his bony chest.
I'm certain you believe you can take me in one of your heartbeats. You may be right at that, but I'd just as soon not find out.
He shook his head sadly.
No, Ghen Greymane. You're afraid because you believe that if you acknowledge here, now with me, that Forsaken aren't irredeemable monsters. If you show any hint of understanding, or kindness, or compassion, or friendship, then that will mean your son died for nothing.
A human cry of rage and pain turned into a wolf's howl as the Gilnean king arched his back. His form shifted, wreathed in mystical smoke as gray as the wolf's pelt. Taller, much more massive, he crouched on his lupine haunches and prepared to spring at Fowl. Tyrallian seized the worgen by the arm, shaking his head.
No bloodshed in this place, he said.
The creature doesn't even have blood,
Ghen snarled, his voice deep and ragged.
He's tied together like a stick puppet with ichor and magic.
I know something about loss,
the archbishop continued. Anduin marveled at Fowl's calmness.
And I know something about you, too. You've held fast to that pain. It's served you well. It's enabled you to fight with unbridled ferocity. But like any edged weapon, it can cut both ways. And right now, it's coming between you and an understanding that could change your world.
I can't change my world!
Ghen cried in a broken voice. The words were still blazing with fury, but shot through them was a deep thread of pain that made Anduin's heart ache.
I want my son back, but that banshee murdered him! She and her kind, your kind, nearly destroyed my people!
Yet here you are,
Fowl continued almost placidly.
Many of you are still healthy, strong, alive.
For the first time since this confrontation began, the undead priest stepped forward.
Answer me this, old friend. If I had not come here alone, if I had brought Liam with me, raised as I was, and still himself as I am, would your answer be different?
The worgen jerked back at words that pierced him more than any blade. He panted, his ears flattened to the back of his skull, his tail lashing in the air. Anduin, himself reeling from the shock of the archbishop's words, lifted his hands, cupping them in preparation for the light. But before he could act, Greymane howled in fury, dropped to all fours, and raced from the room. Anduin started to go after him, but Fowl stopped him.
Let him go, Anduin. Ghen Greymane ever had a temper, and now he's been forced to look at something sad and ugly within himself. He'll either come around in his own time, or he won't. But now, whatever he says, he has realized he cannot tar us all with the same brush. It's a small victory, but I will accept it.
Victory. The single word was laced with more icy abhorrence than Anduin had ever heard, so filled with disgust that it physically hurt him. In the tense moments with Ghen, he had almost forgotten the silent paladin. The two men had reacted differently, but with the same repellence. Tyrallian had no sword and wore no armor, yet he still loomed large and powerful in the cathedral as he straightened to his full height.
If Gen had been racked by anguished fury, Tyrallion, one of the first paladins of the Silver Hand, was brimming with righteous rage.
"You blaspheme what was once a good man," he snapped. "You have stolen his form and parade him about, wearing him as if he were a suit of clothing. Your broken mouth is good for nothing save spewing filthy lies. The undead are unholy. Whatever priestly powers they have come from the shadows of the light, not the light itself. If there is anything left in you of that good, kindly man I loved so much, you capering piece of carnage, come to me, and I will blast him into merciful oblivion."
How could Tyrallion not see what Anduin saw? The High Exarch had embraced a redeemed dreadlord as a companion and fellow soldier. The young king, too, had been initially horrified. But although the legendary paladin doubtless had encountered more dark things, including truly evil Forsaken, than Anduin ever would, Varian's son had seen courage displayed by one of Sylvanas' creations. He held fast to the memory of witnessing Frandis Farley murdered for daring to oppose unnecessary cruelty and violence. He recalled Elsie's letter, how it had nearly broken his heart. He had seen things Tyrallion, in his 1,000 years of war against the Legion, had never witnessed. And now Tyrallion was refusing to see something, someone, who stood right in front of him.
"I created the Order of the Silver Hand," Foul admonished him, his voice growing stronger. "I saw in you something that no one else had. You were a fine priest, but that wasn't what the Light wanted you to be. The Light needed champions who could fight with both the weapons of humanity and the love and power of the Light. The others were strongest with the first and came to the Light later. You were the opposite. They were good, fine men. They were noble paladins. But they are all gone, and you have become the High Exarch of the Light. You are too wise, Tyrallion, to deny the truth. Deny that, and you deny the Light itself."
To Anduin's horror, Fal closed the distance between himself and the paladin. He spread his arms open wide. Tyrallion trembled and his fists clenched, but he did not strike.
"Look for the Light in me," Fal instructed. "You will find it. And if you do not, then I do beg of you to strike me down, for I would not wish to exist as a broken corpse the Light had abandoned."
Anduin looked down to see that Kalia had stepped beside him. She looked up at him, and he saw that she was afraid for her friend. He was too, even though he had met with the Archbishop only recently. "All will be as the Light wills it," he thought. For a moment, Anduin thought the paladin so enraged that he wouldn't even try. But then Tyrallion lifted an arm. A ray of what looked like pure golden sunlight, impossible at this hour of night when that orb hid its head, shone down upon both forms. Tyrallion's face was hard as stone. It was the unforgiving expression of the righteous doing what they deemed to be the right thing. But then, as Anduin watched, transfixed by the silent struggle going on between belief and faith, that granite visage softened. Tyrallion's eyes widened, then the radiant, golden glow that enveloped both the living and the dead caught the glitter of unshed tears. Joy spread across his face. And then, as Anduin watched, moved beyond the ability to speak, Tyrallion, Paladin of the Silver Hand, High Exarch of the Army of the Light, dropped to his knees.
"Your Excellency," he breathed. "Forgive me, my old friend. My arrogance blinded me to what was clear all along had I looked with the right eyes."
And he bent his head for the Archbishop's blessing. Foul, too, was struggling with emotion.
"Dear boy," he said in a voice that shook. "Dear boy, there is nothing to forgive. There was a time when I would have agreed with you. You are the sole living member of the original order, the last of the only sons I would ever have. I am grateful that I have not lost you too. Not to death, or the void, or to your own limitations."
He placed his hand, decaying and lifeless, upon the paladin's gray-gold head. Tyrallion closed his eyes in quiet joy.
"My blessing, such as it is upon you. There is no one, living, dead, or anywhere in the mysterious shades in between who cannot benefit from always looking with eyes, heart, and mind wide open. Rise, my dear boy, and lead even better now, that you have greater understanding of the ways of the light.
Tyrallian did so, appearing clumsy for a moment before straightening. He looked over at Anduin.
I owe you an apology as well, he said. I thought of you as someone who hoped for the best at the cost of wisdom. I could not have been more wrong.
Anduin heard Kalia sigh deeply with relief.
There is no need, he replied. We are taught to fear the Forsaken. And even the Archbishop understands that there are many whose rebirth turned them cold and cruel. But not all.
No, Tyrallian agreed. Not all. I am overjoyed to have my old friend and mentor back. We will work together, Fowl assured him.
If only Greymane could have witnessed this, Kalia said.
Like all people, he will see when he is ready, Tyrallian said. I will certainly reassure him as best I can, but for now, let me do what I can to aid you. Others should be able to have the gift that the Archbishop and I have received this night.
Anduin smiled. He could not see the future, but he could see this moment, and his heart was full.
I will accept your aid most gladly.
Chapter 27 Tanaris.
You know, Grizzik observed as he and Safi prepared their escape, life with you is never dull.
We do keep hopping, don't we?
She replied, and gave him a look that turned his heart all gooey-melty. Grizzik, not being a complete idiot, had anticipated that at some point, someone who did not wish him sunshine and rainbows and a long, happy life might come knocking. He had prepared for the eventuality by digging out, well, by modifying a second shredder to dig out, actually, a tunnel that opened up into a random spot in Tanaris. After Gallywix had departed, they'd decided to make a run for it. They packed up what they could take with them in the little mining cart, including a few airtight casks of azurite, and everything else? Well, some of it couldn't be destroyed, but they dismantled what they could. The bomb set to detonate an hour after they left would also help. All their notes were coming with them. They'd programmed feathers to fly to Teldrassil with a warning about what had happened and a plea for rescue at a specific location. They would offer the Alliance what they had discovered on the stipulation that they would be creating only things that could help, not harm. It was a risk, a crazy glorious one, but it was the only option they had. Neither, they had decided, could live with knowing their discoveries were going to be used to kill so effectively. Just before they left, Grizzik took a long last look around.
I'm gonna miss this place, he admitted.
I know, Grizzy, Safi said, her big eyes filled with sympathy. But we'll find another lab. One where we can create to our heart's content.
He turned to her.
Anywhere in the world. Just so long as it's with you.
Then, as her eyes widened with shock, he knelt in front of her.
Saffronetta Flivers, will you marry me? Again?
In his large green hand, he held one of the azurite rings they had created. The base was rough because neither of them was a jeweler, and the azurite was an imperfect drop that had been allowed to harden. But when Safi said,
Oh, Grizzy, yes!
And he slipped it on her teeny tiny finger, he thought it was the most beautiful ring in the world. He embraced her tightly.
I am one happy goblin,
he said, kissing the top of her head.
Come on, pumpkin. Let's head out on our next adventure.
They descended into the tunnel.
I hope it hasn't caved in. Grizzik said. Haven't checked in a couple of years. I guess we'll find out,
Saffronetta said grimly. It was a long underground trek from Grizzik's lab to the hills that separated Tanaris from Thousand Needles, where Grizzik promised Safi they would emerge. Along the way, they talked openly for the first time, about how much they cared about each other and always had, about what they'd done wrong and how they felt they'd been wronged. Over meals, they analyzed what had worked this time that hadn't worked the last time. And when they slept, they did so snuggled close together. There were no cave-ins, fortunately. And finally, the pair reached the end of this phase of their journey.
According to my calculations, it's about midnight, Safi said.
Grizzik believed her.
Perfect, Grizzik said. It's a pretty remote location, but even so, I'd like to not pop out of this hole in broad daylight. How did you gnomes ever stand living underground, Safi? I'm going bonkers without sunshine.
There's sunshine out there, Safi assured him.
But we'll be living with night elves.
They get sunshine in Teldrassil, too. They just prefer to sleep through it.
You Alliance people are very strange,
he kissed her.
But cute. Definitely cute.
Grizzik had left a ladder at the end, and he climbed up first and undid the latch.
Look out below, he called down. Huh?
Then,
hey! I covered it with sand,
he explained as the yellow grains poured down over them. He didn't mind. Freedom and a life with the gnome he had given his heart 2 years ago awaited him above. He wiped off his face and clambered up the rest of the way, sticking his head up and blinking even in the faint light of the moons and the stars. Nothing looked out of the ordinary. Grizzik cocked his head, listening. He heard nothing.
Okay, I think we're good,
he said, and he hoisted himself up onto the ground. He extended a hand to help Safi out. They stood, stretched, and grinned at each other.
Phase one complete, he said. I'll go back down and bring up the rest of our stuff.
Actually, came a voice. That won't be necessary.
They whirled. A large goblin was silhouetted against the star-studded sky. Grizzik knew that voice. He reached out for Safi's hand and clutched it tightly.
Druz, you and I always got along okay? I tell you what, I'll come back and work for Gallywix. No more tricks. I'll do whatever he wants. You can take everything we got. Just let Safi have some food and water and let her go. Grizzy, I ain't letting you die, Safi, Grizzik said. We got a deal, Druz?
Druz climbed down, followed by no fewer than three other large, irritated-looking goblins.
Sorry, pal. We've been on to you this whole time. Within 5 minutes of you hopping down into your hole, we deactivated the bomb you set to go off in your lab. And as for your parrot, we shot it out of the sky. We just need what you took, and then... He shrugged.
You're not just going to kill us? In cold blood? Safi stammered.
Druz looked at her and sighed.
Little lady, your sweetheart here knew what he was getting you into. This comes directly from the boss. It's out of my hands.
The other goblins leaped forward, grabbing both Grizzik and Safi roughly. Grizzik made a fist and slammed it into the belly of the nearest one. He heard a yelp and a growl from Safi, and figured she'd gotten in a good blow of some sort too. But any resistance on their part was but a gesture. Within a handful of minutes, the goblin and the gnome had been searched, slapped around a bit, and then tied up back to back. Even their feet were bound.
Hey, Druz, I got some notes off the gnome,
one said.
Good job, Kizik, Druz said.
This is dumb, Druz,
Grizzik muttered through a mouthful of blood and broken teeth.
And you ain't dumb. I'm worth a lot more to you alive than dead.
Not really, Druz said. We got all the things you made back in the lab. We got all the things you tried to steal. And now we got the gnome's notes. We can take it from here. You're too great a risk.
Hold me hostage, Safi piped up. You'll guarantee he won't escape.
Safi, shut up, Grizzik hissed angrily. Trying to save you here.
I've got my orders, Druz said, sounding almost apologetic. You ticked off the boss, and this is what we've been told to do with you.
He nodded to Kezig.
Set the bomb.
What?
Back to back with Safi as he was, Grizzik couldn't see her. But she sounded pale.
You try to blow up our stuff, we blow you up. Smaller bomb, though.
Kezig approached and shoved something cold and hard between the bound pair.
Sorry it didn't work out, Grizz. Look at it this way. It'll be fast, and it didn't have to be.
And they walked away, laughing and talking. Grizzik analyzed the situation. It was not good. He and Safi were sitting back to back, tied together tightly with what felt like sturdy rope. Their hands were bound, presumably so they would not be able to work them free and thus untie themselves.
Think maybe if we wriggle, we can scoot away from it?
Safi, always thinking. Despite the awfulness of the situation, Grizzik felt himself smiling.
Worth a shot,
he said, though he didn't